Thank you. So good morning, everyone. So today we are going to be talking about abusive head trauma prevention in a pediatric setting. I have no relationships to disclose. And actually, it's a mother-baby unit setting. I work at the Seton Family of Hospitals. We're a network of hospitals in Central Texas. We have 6 birthing hospitals and a children's hospital. So for those of you who are not as familiar with abusive head trauma, it is the leading cause of child abuse death in Texas and in the U.S. Texas has among the highest rates of child abuse death in the U.S. as well. We also know that the average 191 diagnosed cases of abusive head trauma that occur each year in Texas are really only the tip of the iceberg for a lot of reasons that have to do with surveillance and capture of that data. So what is it? Abusive head trauma can be caused by direct blows to the head, dropping, throwing, shaking a child. And it is now, abusive head trauma is now kind of the recommended terminology by the American Academy of Pediatrics instead of shaken baby syndrome. But so what is shaken baby syndrome then? Shaken baby syndrome is actually a form of abusive head trauma, if you think of abusive head trauma as the umbrella term. And it occurs when an infant is violently shaken by the torso, shoulders, arms, or legs. One of the things that makes the shaking so dangerous is that it involves a whiplash effect that causes bleeding in the brain and bleeding in the eyes and can lead to serious and permanent impairment. So what are the outcomes for victims? Approximately 25% of victims die from their injuries, and those that do survive have serious cognitive impairment, developmental delays, cerebral palsy, blindness, seizures, and really only less than 10% of infants can resume a normal functioning after a shaking episode. So what are the risk factors for abusive head trauma? We know that early infant crying is one of the is the number one trigger for abusive head trauma perpetration. We know that infants ages 1 to 3 months are at the greatest risk for shaking injuries, and many new parents report that they just are not prepared for the sheer quantity and duration of the crying. New babies can cry up to 5 hours a day and be perfectly healthy. And so some of the other risk factors for abusive head trauma perpetration are poverty, financial stress, low education level, young parental age. So parents under the age of 20 are 5 times as likely to shake. And we also know that during the economic downturn, rates of abusive head trauma almost doubled in the United States. So who perpetrates? According to Scribano in 2013, fathers comprise 53% of perpetrators, parent partners 22%, mothers and babysitters 8%, and other adult caregivers comprise 5%. In total, males comprise 78% of perpetrators. So what do we know about from perpetrator confessions? A study by Adamsbaum in France in 2010 found that 70% were parental perpetrators, that 100% of perpetrators described the shaking as extremely violent. A majority of them shook the child more than once, and a number of shaking incidents between 2 and 30 times occurred over weeks and months with the same infant. And 62% said they shook because it stopped the child's crying. So it's kind of a negative feedback loop. And then 24% described impact in addition to shaking. So what do we do about it? At our hospital network, we decided to use the Period of Purple Crying, which is an evidence-based prevention program. It involves a 30-minute training for healthcare professionals. It involves a 3 to 4 minute guided talk by a nurse, a perinatal nurse. And the family's also given a DVD to take home that has two films on it. One film, the 10-minute film, they watched during their hospital stay. So we wanted to evaluate the period of purple crying at our, what is kind of the equivalent of our county hospital, which is University Medical Center Brackenridge. We wanted to describe the families that received the purple program. We wanted to assess the association between family characteristics and who was present in the room to actually receive the intervention. We also wanted to look at program efficacy via the reach of the program, post-intervention knowledge, and parents, participants' intent to share that knowledge. So we conducted a mixed methods evaluation. We looked at the medical record, 707 electronic patient charts. We also did a quality assurance survey. We administered 59 surveys orally in English and Spanish. Those surveys, we really wanted to make sure we weren't interfering with the mother-baby process, the perinatal process, so we made sure those were less than 3 minutes in length and designed at a fifth grade comprehension level. So of the 707 mothers, their mean age was 26.6 years. They were primarily single mothers, at least in terms of marital status. So 62% were not married, but that certainly does not mean that among this population they were not in a committed relationship. 67.9% preferred communicating in Spanish. 44%, an interpreter was used for the purple program, to administer the purple program, and 68% required an interpreter during their hospital stay. So we have a very heavily Spanish-speaking population at this hospital, but also we have a big refugee population. And that hospital is 96.7% public health insurance, so Medicaid, Medicare. So the medical chart review, I was pretty proud of these nurses. 85.4% of cases during the time frame, families received the purple program. 55% were documented correctly. So 85% were documented, 55% were documented correctly. This bar chart kind of shows you in green who didn't receive, the families that didn't receive the period of purple crying. In red, they were charted, and in blue, they were charted correctly. So you can see they really kind of ramped up between July and December and got a lot more accurate with their charting and did a much better job of actually getting it in the patient record. So who received the purple program by family member? You can see in the blue that 58.3% were just it was just the mother. The mother alone received the intervention. In red, we have the mother and father, and that was at almost 33%. And then in green, we have a little sliver, 3%, the father, mother, and another family member. So fathers received, or fathers or significant others received the intervention about 36% of the time. So what were some of the associations that we found? Fathers were more likely to receive the purple intervention when an interpreter was present, or if the delivery was cesarean. When fathers were taught, purple was more likely to be documented correctly, and purple was less likely to be received if the patient had more than 3 lactation consults during hospital stay. So for the QA survey, we found that about, and these were reported by the patient, the nurse reviewed the booklet about 55.8% of the time, so we need to kind of work on program fidelity because they're showing the video, but they're not always giving the nurse talk. And so a little over 91 reported getting the DVD and booklet to take home. 98% of patients reported that they had a working DVD player at home, so that was very promising that at least we were on track with using the right kind of method in terms of giving them a film that they could take home. 88% express an intention to share the purple DVD and booklet with others who care for their baby, and if there were no others that were caring for their baby aside from their partner, 100% reported sharing with their partner. So knowledge outcomes on the QA survey, this was a true-false survey, so it was whether they got these correctly. And so, you know, 98 over 98% knew that it was not okay to shake a baby. 93% knew that it was okay to put a baby in a safe place and walk away if they're feeling very frustrated with their crying. And to, you know, take a little breather for themselves. Almost 95% knew that it was normal for a baby to cry a lot in the first few months of life, and over 96% knew that if you can't soothe the baby, it doesn't make you a bad parent. And that 100% knew that shaking a baby was dangerous. And then the caregiver concern, that it was okay to not let your a caregiver that you're concerned about watch your child, which for single moms and very young single moms, that can be a problem because they may not have someone that they trust who can take care of their baby. So just in summary, 85% of patients had purple documented, almost 95 answered the knowledge questions correctly. Only 36% of fathers got the intervention. The nurse talk was only conducted almost 56% of the time. And lactation consults were sort of getting in the way of purple being administered. But lactation consults are very important. So one thing that we found was that nurses were really making an effort to connect dads and significant others with interpreters and to document correctly when a dad is present. And so since we know that 77% of perpetrators are male and mothers comprise 8% of perpetrators, this is a little bit concerning with who's actually around to get the intervention in the hospital setting. You know, the majority of the mothers are getting it alone, and that's a bit of a problem. So we kind of did some very anecdotal conversations with families, asking, you know, when a dad wasn't there, so what's going on? And we asked nurses as well, and to try to understand these findings a little bit more. And some dads simply were no longer in the picture. Some dads had been deported, and some dads reported that they were fearful of asking for time off, even in this important event of their life, for fear that somebody else would take their job and that they would be, you know, viewed as not hardworking. And so one thing that we really want to be thinking about is how can we make accommodations for dads and significant others so that they can receive the intervention in this population. One kind of accommodation that the nurses found was helpful was waiting to conduct the training in the evening when dads were there, and really making an effort to do that and to coordinate with other team members to make that happen. And then we were also sort of thinking about, well, what could be some maybe less conventional places that we could reach out to dads and significant others. And so really we need to learn more about that in conclusion and kind of understanding what those barriers and avenues to engage dads in abusive head-trauma prevention efforts are. So thank you.
We have time for one question for Sarah right now.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
Given the distribution of the insurance with Medicaid or other publics, under the Affordable Care Act, evidence-based home residency, both pre-meal and post-meal, is going to be paid for, is being paid for, evidence-based. And the question is, if things that and other instruments can be paid for, it's more important to approach the family before the baby is born rather than after. Do you look at this?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point, and them. One thing that we did not cover in this is that we've also partnered with the Nurse Family Partnership and Healthy Families of Travis County so that they can be introducing the concept before the baby's born and reintroducing it after the baby's born and kind of connecting them with resources and support when that baby is crying many, many hours a day and they're feeling really frustrated. So, that's great. And so it's actually the period of purple crying is a three-dose model. And so the primary prevention component occurs in birthing hospitals. The secondary prevention component occurs in home visiting and prenatal visits. And there's all kinds of ways that that can be also carried out through WIC clinics, through all kinds of different organizations that can be kind of showing the video in their waiting rooms and sharing that information. And the third component is a public information campaign.